Hello, I'm Bruce Edwards, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In this program, MIT's Dave Donaldson talks about the economic impact of India's 19th century railroads.
So it started with an interest in just something that made it easier for people to trade with each other, and the railroads, you know, was a good example of that.
Trading gold for salt is clearly a thing of the past, but studying the market for salt in 19th century India and the effects on trade of building a railroad led economist Dave Donaldson to important new findings that are relevant today. Donaldson's work on trade won him the 2017 John Bates Clark Medal, awarded for the most significant contributions by an economist under the age of 40. Donaldson is profiled in the June 2018 edition of Finance and Development magazine, and I began our conversation by asking him why the interest in India.
So I was attracted to India partly because it's a fascinating place that I'd read a bit about, partly because my advisors did all their work on India, and that enthusiasm was kind of infectious, and then. But finally, I identified that India, up till only about a year ago, was a rare example of a country that actually taxes trade within the country. So when trade crosses state borders in India, this changed about a year ago. But 10 years ago, when I worked on this, and 50 years ago, when these taxes started, when goods cross state borders, they incurred a tariff of 15 or 10 or whatever percent tariff. You know, that's the kind of thing that doesn't happen at all in most countries. You know, the U.S. is constitutionally prohibited. So I was interested in those taxes, and I went to India on a sort of, a fact-finding mission to get the paper trail on those taxes. How big are they? Where are they? Did they change over time? How could we study about this? Is there any data? And it was funny. So I talked to a lot of Indian economists, and they all said, this intranational trade prohibition is in. Modern-day India is interesting, but the thing that really united India, the thing that really changed intranational trade in India was the railroads, of course, 130, 150 years ago. And I have to, my first instinct was, what I'm really interested in is in India today, not India 100 years ago. But the idea grew on me, and I started to think that the big historical change might be something we could learn a lot from. And it would also have the benefit that that it's not just a change in trade costs, it was also the return on a huge public infrastructure investment, which is something else that economists need to know more about. Making it easier for people to move and for goods to move around a country, that doesn't come for free. You know, there's an open question of is that spending worth it? And that was something else I thought I could look at with that historical episode.
So one of the things about your work is that you never stray too far from the question of how it affects welfare. So that study, what was the takeaway there in terms of the railroad? Did it in fact, and does it increase welfare of the people that are using the system?
Yeah, no, I think it's important to, not all problems we work on should be mapped back to that, but I do think it's one of the attractions for me of economics as an endeavor is an attempt to do something quite profound, which is sort of to use how people make choices to kind of backward infer from the choices that people make in response to different options, in a sense, different menus, to sort of present people with menus, different menus, see the choices they make, and then from that backward engineer how much better off they would be under menu A or menu B. You might kind of think, okay, what does this have to do with railroads? Well, a lot of these things that I've worked on, like railroads, have that kind of flavor. I mean, we could choose to trade with each other under the inferior, old-fashioned pre-railroad technology, but now I offer you a new option, which is this railroad option. You still have the old option, right? Presumably, people could still use boats and bullock carts, or walk and carry things, but now I give you another option. So it would be a little bit surprising if this sort of were to be bad, but in the real world, probably the most serious way in which this could be bad is more that it's bad for some people. It might be good on average for most people or for the sort of dollar weighted average person, but it might be bad for some people. You know, that's a very realistic scenario. The sort of famous example from the U.S. case was, you know, the scholars of railroads talked about was how, yeah, these new railroad towns like Chicago thrived, but they, part of the way they thrived was by the fact that they were now enjoying some of the economic activity that used to take place at river towns, you know, so, and so those former river trading hubs would suffer, and a railroad town would thrive, and the aggregate better off statement would be that the guy thriving is thriving by more than the guy who's suffering is suffering, but that doesn't mean that there's not displacement and sort of, you know, losers from a change as well as winners. Okay, but all that said, I didn't, in my work on Indian railroads, I didn't choose to focus much on that, like, heterogeneity. I was interested in a statistical estimation procedure that, you know, was aimed at trying to estimate the average effect on the average locality. And that number turns out to be about 16% of their, of the GDP, a proxy for welfare, that they get from agricultural goods, which was about 2/3 of consumption. So it's kind of, so consider it kind of maybe 16% of 2/3.
In the study, you chose to look at the production of salt in India, and I think that's interesting. Why did you choose salt? I mean, there's a lot of things that were being produced at the time. Why was salt a good thing to look at?
Yeah. Well, I owe this to a professor at the LSE where I studied, who we had a sort of weekly tea kind of session that he, you know, generously attended, and to sort of just have impromptu conversations with people like me and a student at the time. And I told him I was working on Indian history, and he said, "Have you read this book called The Great Hedge of India?" And I said, "No, I never even heard of this." You know, he said, "Oh, well, you must read it. You must find a way to get the hedge into your paper." You know, so it's kind of a wonderful book. It's written by a British librarian, who stumbled upon these historical documents as part of his job about British India that were to do with this so-called salt hedge. And he said, "This is just preposterous. This can't be a thing." And the book is about the history, what the salt hedge was, and his lifelong journey to go to India and try to find any trace of this great hedge. But basically what happened was, you know, the British were interested in taxing India. And they knew that one of the smartest things to tax, if you're interested in generating revenue, is a commodity that is demanded in sort of very fixed amounts. So, you know, it's sort of, think about that as, no matter what the price is, we're just going to still buy a lot, right? That kind of means you can jack the tax way up and people will still buy a lot. So they, of course, realize salt is doubly beneficial because in the north it can only be produced in a small number of inland locations. So on the coast you can always turn salt water into salt with sort of panning technologies, but in the heart of the country that you need a mine or you need a big salt lake, and there were only a few of those things. So they said, okay, well, this is what we should do. We should charge basically a tax at the mine. So as soon as the good leaves the mine, we slap a tax on it. And the tax was sometimes 200%. I mean, it was an incredible tax. And it was an incredible source of revenue. And of course, Gandhi, this is one of the sources of Gandhi's and the Congress's protest movement was the sort of this salt tax. But they quickly realized that the most profitable thing to do was to build a big wall or hedge right across the middle of India, separating the south from the north, so that everybody to the north of the line would have to pay the tax on the northern stuff. And then every time the salt crossed the hedge, then you would have to pay the price to cross the hedge. It was just a customs wall, basically, only for the purposes, effectively, of collecting salt taxes for the most of the period. Okay, so I read about all this history and found it fascinating, but quickly realized that salt had a completely auxiliary benefit for me that it had nothing to do with really a lot of this history, which was, apart from the fact that because of that history, they collected a lot of data about salt. So there were entire reports every month called, like, the salt report, you know. But for me, this meant that there was data, but it also meant one very important thing for me, which was, so the kind of good you'd expect to see a big effect on is salt, because if it can only be produced in one location, yet you know that it gets to some other location, then if you, prior to the railroads, those places will be, you know, it's produced at A, it gets to B, And even though it costs a lot in B, thanks to that high pre-railroad trading technology of boats and bullocks, you know, you will still see the good for sale in B, because salt is the kind of thing everybody needs some of. You know, it's a necessity. So then you see this price gap between A, where it's made, and B, where it's consumed before the railroads, and you also see this price gap between A and B after the railroads get built. And that reduction in prices at B, at this kind of destination location, you know, under some idealized assumptions, reveals exactly how much railroads reduce the cost of shipping. So, okay, so that goods like salt, where we know the origin, anytime we see the good for sale at a destination, we know the origin it came from, are very advantageous for studying trade, basically. And that was why I ended up focusing on salt for that first step that I described earlier, which was how much did railroads actually reduce the cost of trading.
That's really interesting. So, how does that work in like our digital economy? This economic concept of you know, having a product produced in location A and then shipped or transported to location B where it's sold at a higher price.
Yeah.
How does that work in the digital economy?
The theory of why you'd expect that to hold, it requires some cost of moving the goods from A to B, but it also requires that there's some competition, or in the limit, lots of competition, perfect competition. So the reason that's true is because, imagine just for a second that you're a company like maybe Apple that produces your thing, and you make it in China, and you sell it in lots of destinations around the world. I mean, what's to prevent you from selling it for $100 here and $200 there? You know, maybe there's a cost-based reason. I mean, just because the production cost in China is the same, no matter whether we sell it in China or America, you might say the retail cost, you know, is different. That's a very plausible story for such price differences. But there's another plausible story, which is just that they might face consumers in the one destination market who have a lower willingness to pay for their thing, or, you know, than people in some other destination market. And that's often called so-called market segmentation. You know, so you'd like to find the high valuation consumers, the ones that'll pay anything for your product, and charge them a lot, and find the low valuation consumers and charge them a little. And as long as that little is still higher than your cost of production, you do that. So in the real world, market segmentation is very hard to do because, you know, in a sense, you can't, within a country, you can't prevent the high valuation consumers from pretending to be low valuation consumers, right? So that's, you know, one of the reasons airlines offer business class tickets and economy class tickets and now even premium economy class tickets is to try to force people to choose which type of consumer they are and then, you know, offer them a menu to it. Okay. But internationally, this, you know, the same thing might come up, but of course it's very hard for American consumers to pretend to be Chinese consumers without actually going to China and buying the iPad there, right? Or paying a firm to do the same thing for them. And so that kind of, you know, the kind of international market segmentation is much easier for firms to do it. And that's why we see, especially for these high value goods, prices being so different across countries. However, that's an example where the good is kind of a monopolized good, right? I mean, it's but for a commoditized good like salt, you could try to sell it way above marginal cost in a market with high valuation consumers, but unfortunately your competition will start to undercut you. You're not a monopolist on salt, it's a commoditized thing. And we have reason to believe that competition process would probably drive the price kind of down, maybe eventually to something like its kind of cost of production plus maybe some normal amount of profit. And that in that world, then you'd get that implication I said earlier, where a place that you and all the competition agree is cheaper to get to, like destination one, would be a cheaper, the price of the good would be cheaper there than in some other destination that we all agree is harder to get to. I mean, when I think about digital goods, I think of things that are often not commoditized. They have with them something like monopoly rights, property rights. Think of music files, right? I mean, it's exactly, or a copy of Microsoft Windows. I mean, it's exactly the same thing. It's arrangement of electrons on a web somewhere that you download, you know, but no matter where you download it, but these firms find reasonable ways to segment markets. And so, you know, absolutely, we expect the prices to differ dramatically around the world for demand-based reasons. That is, differences in willingness to pay or evaluations, and nothing to do with cost-based differences. In the limit, the cost-based differences are zero.
So I'm struck by economics being a social science. There's so many variables, and there's so many things that are not clear, unknown parameters. And you with a degree in physics, which is a hard science, does the physicist in you come up against the economist sometimes when you're trying to figure these things out? Do you have problems sort of reconciling the variability of the science in economics, given your background in the hard science?
Yeah, I do. I should say, I did an undergraduate degree in physics. I mean, that can often mean you get a very rosy view of the world, of the way that field embraces the world. You don't get told about all the dead ends that people tried and that failed, and all the theories that looked right for 40 years and then got rejected and they're relegated to the dustbins of history. Anyway, so the thing about a science, a hard science, a non-social science, if you like, a physical science, is that it's often, not always, but often easy to isolate components of the system and become a sort of extremely confident in your analysis of that component. So I've read an article recently about some big puzzle in a branch of quantum physics about some property of the proton that I can't even recall, but it's basically a dispute that involves like the 14th decimal place about some measurement of this proton, and how 20 years ago they thought that the 14th decimal place was not just not very accurately measured. So the fact that measurement wasn't lining up with theory was just a bit of bad luck in the apparatus. But then 20 years of apparatus improvements and increased repetition of this have now led them to think, okay, actually we have a problem here. The theory is not lining up. But we think about that. They're taking a single proton. So that's just a astoundingly microscopic component of reality, right? Yet they're able to find ways to isolate it and figure out how it works down to the 14th decimal place. So I think we, as economists, don't have that, the equivalent of that micro structure that we can understand well and then just sort of aggregate up. So that gives an example of how, in some sense, maybe I think social sciences are a little awkward because we neither have that micro unit that we sort of really think is stable and behaves in a certain way, follows a bunch of laws always and everywhere that we could ever hope to figure out. Obviously, you might think the micro unit is a human being, but obviously, human beings don't follow laws of behavior always and everywhere, so it would be foolish to sort of start and say you could hope to figure that out. But equally, the macro units that matter to us, whether they're the market for salt in a corner of India, or the market for T-bills right now, or the market for loans on Wall Street. These things are not at that blissful macro level where all our things we don't understand just sort of always perfectly cancel out. That's the physics example of when they work on the big macro stuff. In that Stylex example I gave earlier. So I think, unfortunately, we're kind of stuck in the middle. The things we want to know don't have that kind of super felicitous properties of aggregation.
So do you think that do you see the field of economics changing dramatically with the digital economy?
I should say at the outset, the biggest change by far in economics, I think, in the last 10, 20 years has to be the arrival of data. Not just the arrival, but the massive flood of availability of data that we have. So an example I always like to use is when I started my work on India as a grad student 15 years ago, I was excited, over the moon about the fact that this was an extremely rare scenario where we could observe trade of goods within a country. It happened to be 130 years ago in India. It happened to be extremely fortuitous for me that was true, because I could look at that second step that I referred to earlier of how the railroads changed how much and what was traded. But the fact that the data existed was a kind of a miracle. Such data doesn't get collected for most countries even today. The U.S. does a small survey every 5 years of intranational commodity flows. Recently, I started a project about this high-speed rail stuff in China, where we have access to all the credit card transactions in China. so the main credit card clearinghouse, they are willing to work with researchers and say, you know, yeah, you can tap into our servers and access that bank of like, you know, terabytes of data, and you can ask it questions that are anonymized. You know, you can't ask it, you know, you can't map the credit card identifiers to anything else. But of course, it's not ideal data. It wasn't collected for the purpose of studying trade, unlike the British thing or the US Commodity Flow Survey. But it gives us a pretty unique window on sort of, there's a credit card ID here that on this date and time bought $112 worth of stuff from this merchant ID over here. You know, that is kind of trade data at some level. I've also been looking at tax data where, you know, within countries, thanks to the way they collect taxes, you can see every time a transaction is made, a tax is charged, and that transaction gets registered in the government's own administrative data bank. So, you know, the fact that data is digitized and archived, and that there are partners that are willing to share anonymized versions of it, is a total game changer. You know, 10, 15 years ago, like I said, most data sets that economists would use would be official data sources, like a census or a survey of firms or a monthly survey of American workers and their wages and their employment trajectories and things. You know, nowadays the data environment has completely changed.
That was Dave Donaldson, professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and 2017 John Bates Clark medalist. A profile of Donaldson entitled Sherlock of Trade is featured in the June 2018 edition of Finance and Development magazine. The magazine is available online at imf.org/FND, or you can download the Finance and Development app to read it on your mobile device. And if you like this podcast, subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also now follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast.